This is an excerpt from The High Frontier by Gerard K. O'Neill. History teaches us that a strong, expanding frontier movement can endure only if it has a sound economic driver. The driver for the westward movement of our 19th century was the wealth of resources on successive new geographical frontiers. Beyond Earth, the nearest frontier within our solar system is low Earth orbit, and it is relatively barren. Solar energy is only available half-time there. Low orbit has no material resources. The nearest source of resources is the moon, and the next nearest, typically 1,000 times as far away, is the Earth-approaching asteroids. Lunar and asteroidal materials have great value, not because they are different from elements found on Earth, but because of their energy of height. They are at the top of Earth's gravitational mountain, while we are at the bottom. Because of that difference, it takes less than 5% as much energy to lift materials from the moon into space as it does to lift equal amounts from the Earth. Materials at the top of Earth's gravitational mountain will therefore go into products needed in space. When a large number of people are living in space, it will be clear which of the products they use will be made in space. All of them, except those which are so light and so labor-intensive in their manufacture that Earth's industries can supply them competitively in spite of transport costs. So I moved to Freeland, New Jersey in 1969 at age 10. Freeland is the town that is spoken of in my hometown, the song you just heard. That summer, we watched Armstrong and Aldrin walk on the surface of the moon, and our family named our new kitten Apollo 11, or Polly for short, because she was a girl. A few years later in middle school, I did a research project on the hydrogen economy, by which renewable sources of energy plus water would be turned into energy and power for our utilities, our homes, our factories, any day now. I was devouring books on human evolution. I was reading National Geographic, Psychology Today, Omni, Scientific American. And I found it to be profound to dwell on the long sweep of history, things like the origins of the universe, the formation of our galaxy, our solar system, the Earth, life on Earth, the human species, and civilization. As I studied more science classes, especially biology, I came to find the theology of my Episcopal Church, which my family had attended every Sunday for my whole life, to be in conflict with this science, and I found the science to be more compelling. And I struggled over this for a while. I felt like I needed to make a choice, and the choice I felt I needed to make was to choose science over supernatural-based beliefs. And I recognize that I could be wrong. I don't think so. Having abandoned my parents' faith, I tried to assemble a worldview and a purpose for my life that would make sense to me. My favorite science fiction authors, Asimov and Heinlein, plus Star Trek, which I loved, tended to focus on broad themes of expressing a vision for a hopeful future for humanity, in which we survive. We don't wipe ourselves out in a nuclear cataclysm, right? That would be good. And maybe even thrive for eons, for thousands of years. And I took that on, and so I determined that at least part of my life would be devoted to taking steps along a path that led to a positive outcome for humanity. But in the mid-1970s, and some of us will remember that time, it was not entirely clear that we were on that path. There was a lot of pollution, litter, the war in Vietnam, race relations, Cold War, political assassinations, And we were losing entire industries, such as textiles and clothing. You may remember the buy the union label, Made in America things. And so Springsteen's song, My Hometown, which is about Freehold, captures some of that about the racial turmoil and the factory closings. That abandoned textile mill that he sings about, it loomed over the town. It was this enormous structure right in the middle, and it had 100 windows, and half of them were broken. People had been throwing stones at it. It was just a reminder of, how you can have loss and how, things moving forward is not necessarily guaranteed. Also, during my high school years, 73 to 77, that was when the Arab states held the OPEC oil embargo, and also U.S. oil production had peaked out and was on the decline. The result was that we had fuel shortages, spiking prices, inflation, and a recession. Then, in the summer of 76, I was at Ithaca College for a six-week program studying physics and chemistry. And one of the professors there, a Ithaca College physics professor, told me about Gerard K. O'Neill, and that he was a physics professor who had written an article that appeared in Physics Today magazine about space colonies, and that he had also written a book, The High Frontier. And this professor advised me that I should read the book, I should apply to Princeton, I should go there, and when I get there, I should look up Gerard O'Neill. And that's what I did. I wish I remembered the professor's name. but anyway, I did follow his advice. So Gerard K. O'Neill had a prestigious career as a kind of hardcore physicist. He was in the field of high energy physics. And in 1956, while he was just an instructor at Princeton, and this is a quote, he published a letter in Physical Review entitled Storage Ring Synchrotron, Device for High Energy Physics Research. In two pages, it laid down the path that high energy physics has followed since, end quote. And then this led to a team from Princeton and Stanford building the first high-energy colliding beam experiment. And in 1965, that experiment revealed the size of the electron, which had not been, which, you know, it had a lot of, wasn't known at the time. In 1969, Professor O'Neill was given the honor of being the lecturer for the large introductory physics class. So this is Physics 103, which I took when I got there a few years later, not from him. But so this class is it's kind of a big production. So it's a large class that's got people that are going to major in physics or the whole engineering school and a bunch of other people. I'll take this class, and it's held in a big hall, and they have this rather elaborate system for putting on demonstrations, and so it's a real show. So you have the one lecture a week, and they do really cool demonstrations. The one I loved the most was for electricity. They bring out Van de Graaff generators that had been built by Van de Graaff. Okay, pretty cool. but this was 1969, and he observed that his students were being affected by the turmoil and the uncertainty of those times. And yet there was also the contrast with kind of the hope of the Apollo program. And he says about that in the appendix of his book, students who sensed that they had talents in science or engineering were on the defensive, accused by their colleagues of being irrelevant or counterproductive, right? Because they would be told, well, you're just going to go work on nuclear bombs or something like that, right? So in the fall of 69, for teaching this class, he chose the Apollo program as a unifying theme. But as a supplement to the class, he formed an honors seminar of the top 10 students, and he intended to pose them a series of questions that they would discuss. But he didn't get very far in that because the very first question that he asked was so engaging that they ended up talking about it for the rest of the year. And that question was simply this: is a planetary surface the right place for an expanding technological civilization? And I'll say it again later. So they quickly decided against planetary surfaces as being the answer to that, since at best that only provides for a doubling of the population. And that happens every few decades. So if you're talking about 1,000 years, that's not going to help much. So having decided that, they took on the task of figuring out how to build this, because this is a new idea. You couldn't really look this up anywhere. So a bunch of freshman physics students, and led by this professor, started inventing the orbiting space colony. So the basic idea was to take material from the shallow gravity wells of Earth's moon and the asteroids and process it into building materials like aluminum, glass, and steel, and then build enormous rotating either rings or spheres, or perhaps the most efficient structure is a cylinder. And the rotation would produce artificial gravity. And that could be exactly the same as it is on the Earth's surface, or a little less, or a little more, probably not a little more, but it could be whatever you wanted it to be. And the conditions there could replicate the living conditions on Earth. For example, the one he highlights is a small Italian village where everybody knows each other. So he built these little rolling landscapes into the interior of these cylinders. Because there's so much material available from the moon and from the asteroids, and the energy from the sun is nearly infinite, we could build enough of these things to add up to over 1,000 times the living surface on the planet Earth. And every bit of it could be habitable, could be a pleasant place to live. So over the next several years, he did more design work on his own. He also discussed it with colleagues. He tried to publish it early on as an article in some magazine. And so he wrote up an article and he sent it out to what he thought was the most likely, and got a rejection slip, and he tried again. It took him 6 years before he was able to talk the editor of Physics Today into publishing an article about that. But that was really important because that led to hundreds of letters from colleagues, other physicists, with questions, suggestions, critiques, and he would he responded to these in detail. So he got an exhaustive peer review by professional physicists of his ideas. He next organized a small conference at Princeton University about space colonies, and Princeton University put out a press release because the money had been routed through the university, so that's what they normally do when there's an officially sanctioned conference. So the press release led to some reporters attending the conference, and one of them was from the New York Times. And the next day, there was a front page article on the New York Times about space colonies. So that just led to a huge level of interest. There were media from all over the world calling O'Neill, and so I'm sure he was having a little trouble keeping up with whatever his regular day job was at that point. But he did. He took interviews. He traveled. He got the message out and engaged with the public. And then he, shortly after that, he turned his ideas into this book, The High Frontier. And the first chapter of that has a long letter home from one of the colonists. You know, and so it was really very engaging, and really this caught the imagination of an awful lot of people. And so some of the people that kind of caught fire with this formed their own new organization called the L5 Society. Now, L5 is Lagrange point number 5. So between the Earth and the Moon, there's Lagrange points 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so L5 is not actually a single point, but it's a whole bunch of orbits that all have the same basic characteristic that they... Anyway. coffee hour, right? So the L5 Society named itself after this location that he described in his book. And I'm wondering how many current or former L5 or National Space Society members we might have in the audience. 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, not that many, but a few. Oh, yeah, so the L5 Society formed itself independent of Gerry O'Neill, as far as I understand it. And then it merged with another organization, became the National Space Society, which is alive and well today. And I was at their conference a year ago, or a month ago, and Gerry was there, one of the leaders of it. So NASA also was very interested in this idea, at least for a while. They funded O'Neill to build a device that he had invented as an enabling technology for this, something he called the mass driver. So this combined his two loves. So it looked suspiciously like a linear accelerator in high energy physics, but instead of subatomic particles or atoms, it accelerated, you know, big things like. So the one I worked on in his lab would accelerate payloads about this big, and then his next generation was going to be about accelerating things about yay big. And if you Google my name and mass driver, you can get to the NSS website, which will have the abstract to my paper that I wrote as part of my senior independent work at Princeton. So. You can get verification I'm not making all this up. So today, there's not really a shortage of space visionaries. We have a few of them that are out there, pretty public about it. So Elon Musk, anybody heard of him? He founded SpaceX with the goal of making humankind an interplanetary species, right? There's a fellow named Robert Zubrin, who argues passionately and strongly for why we should be settling Mars in a book, The Case for Mars. And he started something called the Mars Society, an echo of the L5 Society, to enlist others in his advocacy for that. Buzz Aldrin, you may remember, he shows up at these conferences pretty regularly. He's pushing an idea called the Mars Cycler, where you can have a big, heavy vehicle that's kind of like a luxury liner, and it leaves from Earth to Mars, does a gravity encounter that alters its orbit a little bit so that it heads right back to Earth, does a gravity encounter there, makes it head back to Mars, okay, Mars Cycler. So there's a lot of activity there, but I think that Gerry's original question, is a planetary surface the right place for an expanding technological civilization, I think can be answered as both a yes and a no. Well, maybe it's not necessarily where you start, but it's probably where you finish. So there's still a lot of value to having settlements on Mars. And on the moon, maybe not settlements exactly, but maybe it's more like the Antarctica or an oil derrick. You know, it's a place where you go to do work, but you wouldn't want to raise a family there because conditions are too rough. I think his solution of orbiting habitats, accommodating an exponentially expanding human population, is still on the right track. It's not currently part of NASA's plans, and O'Neill was always kind of skeptical about whether governments were going to be the ones to push forward on this. His point was that it needed to be, it needed to be economically driven. That if it didn't make sense economically, it wasn't going to happen. So it was probably going to be led by private companies. And guess what? That seems to be where we're going. You know, you've got these wealthy industrialists like Elon Musk on the forefront of pushing for us having large numbers of people living out in space, and no government entity is currently doing that. Very interesting. 30 years later, some of his predictions are very relevant and coming into fruition. So I think each of us can contribute to a better tomorrow by living our lives in an exemplary manner. A humanist perspective recognizes the value of each person and that they have much to contribute and are worthy of prosperity. So, and a planet, home Earth, with healthy ecosystems that can be sustained forever is critical to supporting a healthy and happy human population over the long term. I think that humanist and Earth-centered traditions in the UU faith are well aligned with the O'Neill vision. For me personally, Jerry O'Neill provided me hope and inspiration at a critical point in my life. I've watched with some dismay as his ideas that were prominent when I was a young man have gradually disappeared from NASA plans and priorities. But today, there are enabling and motivating events occurring. We found water at the lunar poles and in large quantities on the surface of Mars. We sent a lander there, it scraped the surface, and it was all white, and then it sublimated away. So Mars has lots of water. We have major American corporations that are planning to extract and use the water on the moon to enable them to have ease of transportation around the Earth-Moon system, including the United Launch Alliance, which is a joint venture of Lockheed Martin and Boeing. So we're talking about some big players planning to make use of some of these ideas in the near future. We also have a major industrialist who supports the O'Neill vision. Jeff Bezos followed a similar path than I did. So he read The High Frontier when he was in high school, was inspired by it, went to Princeton, worked with O'Neill there, did another step further, which is that he led a organization called the Students for Exploration and Development of Space. And then he went on and did a few other things, right? And now I got to be there at the National Space Society's International Space Development Conference about a month ago when we gave him an award, and he got up and said that the O'Neill vision is his vision, and that he started this company, Blue Origins, that is making reusable rockets to promote the O'Neill vision, and he's with us. So, So it's we've come a long way from to this point when I think some of these ideas are going to really pick up some steam, and you're all going to be hearing about them, not just from me. So I hope that each of you have in your heart a positive and hopeful vision of the future. And I offer to you the O'Neill vision to be part of that. And I hope it brings you some peace, as it has for me. Thank you.